Hey, Kayla.
Hi, Blake Strode. How are you?
I am okay. It is a Friday afternoon as we are recording this, and we're back with another episode of Under the Arch. This is
your favorite podcast.
Your favorite podcast, and a podcast where we explore the issues facing our communities and the people fighting to transform them. And I am Blake Strode, Executive Director of Arch City Defenders.
And I'm Kayla Reed, Executive Director of Action St. Louis.
And we have another great convo teed up for you all today.
We say that every time, but it actually really is another great
conversation. Because there's so much happening in St. Louis in the news every day right now. St. Louisans know this well. Every single day, the headlines are like, one is head scratchier than the next. And a lot of them are around public safety right now. You know, we've talked about local control and what's going on at the state level and the police department and the prosecutor's office. And, you know, we got to throw the jails into the mix. Yeah.
And I think that's important because, you know, not our work has been really about pretrial detention and the jails in the city of St. Louis for some time. If you don't know and you're listening, one of our sort of historic campaigns is the Close the Workhouse campaign. And pretrial detention in this city is something that goes really far back and was, you know, how many of us learned about Arch City Defenders and the work that they did around municipal courts and jailing, and then how that sort of evolves into the work that we've done to bail people out, and then ultimately the Close the Workhouse campaign. So for Action in Arch City, the conversation around jails is always relevant and needs to be discussed because it really is sort of a pulse on the rest of the city. Right. And so when we are in these moments of letting public safety be anchored inside of fear mongering and conversations about crime and violence, what we know happens is that our jails start to fill up more and more. And we start to really step away from a progressive vision of where and what safety could look like in our community.
Yeah, I really appreciate you grounding us in that organizing and advocacy around the Workhouse and the Close the Workhouse campaign, because I think that campaign helped to generate just a lot more scrutiny on local systems of incarceration and institutions of incarceration. And it has led to many things. You know, we've talked multiple times on this podcast and elsewhere around the story of the Workhouse itself, which currently sits empty. There's lots of commentary about that fact on all sides of that reality. But it has also led to a conversation with the current mayor, Mayor Tashara Jones, around oversight and and quality seems like a strange word, probably not one I would choose, but I think they might choose, of the corrections function in St. Louis and what it is that people are exposed to when they're being held in cages that are run by the city of St. Louis. And that prompted a whole slew of work around civilian oversight. And that's really going to be the topic of a lot of our conversation today.
Yeah. Many things have happened in our jails. And so we're going to talk about that. And I'm super excited to introduce our guest today, who, you know, St. Louis is so small. We always know this. We went to college together over at Washington University. Really excited to welcome you onto this podcast. Janice, how are you?
I'm good. I actually forgot that we went to college together.
We did go to college together. That makes me feel like I was just, I don't know. But yeah, we did. We had a few classes together. You were, you know, on your way out when I on your way out. Not to make college sound like a crossroad place, but we're almost free. from the bondage that is these academic institutions. So I'm just going to read your bio, but then of course want to make space for you to just let us know anything else we should know. But Janice is the grants manager, management associate at Proteus Fund, thank you, and has enjoyed a career in the nonprofit industry since attending WashU in St. Louis. At WashU, Janice found a passion for queer and Black studies as well as Spanish, graduated class of 2019 with a women, gender, sexualities degree. Prior to their return to development, Janice worked as a development intern and student worker, a pro bono law intern, a youth organizer, and case manager for women and trans people who have survived prisons. They now serve as a volunteer lead organizer for the Youth Participatory Defense Hub and a member of the Detention Facility Oversight Board for the City of St. Louis, currently back in the academic world, pursuing a graduate degree in nonprofit management at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to the podcast, Janice.
Thank you. Yes, that's all true. And I would say the only update is at that point I was a member and now I'm chair of the board, the DFOB.
Yes. Yeah. Chairing these boards.
And if I can say, just does a masterful job of chairing really those good meetings. I mean, and one of my colleagues who also watches faithfully the DFOB meetings has also commented on how ably Janice directs. It's not easy always to you know, follow the rules and make sure everyone's included and keep the agenda going and highlight important issues. So also just want to say, you're natural. You do that very well. And we're glad to have you on the program today. I also, since we're talking about, you know, past connections, Janice was an intern at Arch City Defenders.
Yes.
Some years back. That's how I first met Janice. So it's just been, it's been great to watch you move through various roles and be in the ones you're in now. And yeah, and want our listeners to hear more about that journey. So that's actually a natural place to start. Tell us a little bit more about what landed you where you are today. How'd you end up here? Are you from St. Louis?
No, I'm not. I came here about 6 years ago when I was accepted to WashU. So I think I came in 2016. It's been 7 years now.
Okay. Where are you from originally?
Augusta, Georgia, but I moved around a lot. So I was only there for a bit.
And what got you involved in the kind of organizing and social justice and policy scene in St. Louis?
Yeah. So I've lived a lot of different places in the U.S., Georgia, Florida, New Jersey, Illinois, and St. Louis is very unique. The first thing that really made an impact on me as being unique to St. Louis is the police here and the police brutality here, and that it is so pervasive and affects me and other people all over the city. What got me into being interested in advocating with the incarcerated or formerly incarcerated community were my experiences at WashU. My experiences there were largely negative. The one I'm thinking of in particular was over my spring break, I think when I was a junior, when the private police, WashU has a private police force, and they work together with the WashU Med School's private police force and the neighboring St. Louis College of Pharmacy's armed security guards. And they harassed me. They accused me of trespassing because they didn't believe I went to WashU. One of their guards threatened to shoot me. It was a whole terrible affair that ended with them calling the city police and dragging me off in handcuffs, putting me in the back of a van, and then they just dropped me off at my house, which they knew my address because it was on a piece of mail that they found in my bag that they rifled through, even though I said I did not consent to a search. And it was a terrible experience. A lot of people had video of me being arrested, well, caught and released. And the armed security guards also told me that I was under arrest. And at that point, I didn't understand that an armed security guard is not a police officer and doesn't have the right to arrest me, which makes sense now because I asked if I had the right to remain silent. And the armed security guard said, well, no. So following that incident that happened one more time at that same spot, and after that, I guess St. Louis College of Pharmacy armed security guards talked to the WashU Med private police, which talked to the WashU undergrad private police, and they talked to the student board and tried to have me sanctioned under four different things. And I had MJ Voss at Art City Defenders, who I was interning for, write them a letter saying, we'll take this seriously as a case and I need time to prepare for it. And then they dropped all of the sanctions and all of the accusations, and their tone changed.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, that, what a story. We could have a whole podcast unpacking the layers of private and public and academic institution, and the role that, you know, just having a legal advocate and attorney present shifts the dynamics entirely, which many people, as we all know, don't have the benefit of having in those moments.
Yes. Yeah, that's actually what made me so passionate about this, is that I recognize that my class privilege got me out of that situation in a way that other Black people in St. Louis could not get out of that situation. I only knew MJ because I was able to do an unpaid internship, which not everyone has the access to. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's actually when I started with volunteering with Metropolitan Congregations United on their participatory defense hub, helping youth who are facing charges with the Division of Youth Services.
Hmm. Can you say more about that for folks that aren't as familiar with participatory defense? What does that mean?
Yeah, sure. So the idea of participatory defense focuses on participating with the families who are the defendants. I mean, technically the youth is the defendant, but we help youth and their families understand the court process, what's going on, what all of these legalese and Latin terms mean. We help put together a social biography, which is a packet that shows the judge the youth as a whole person. We include their biopsychosocial context. We include character letters from friends, family, clergy, football coaches, things like that. And we really just try to humanize them. And we find that it makes a huge difference in their cases, having them return to the community while on probation, or for youth it's called supervision, or having their case dropped entirely. And I found that there are a lot of things about juvenile court that people don't know and that I didn't know. I didn't know that there was no jury. We found that in many cases, evidence isn't really considered or argued like it is on TV. They kind of just go straight to punishment, really. And there's not many supportive services, and it's difficult, but we do what we can.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think we have heard across all the seasons that we've been doing this podcast and just in our work in general, how, you know, a personal story can spark a lifetime of advocacy and work, right? And, or it can really just take people completely out and away from this work. And so grateful that you do this work every day, and deeply, deeply sorry that it took such a that horrific thing happened to you in the first place. And, you know, when you think about colleges in this city, the way that they craft these bubbles to try to keep students away from the rest of the city, but then you still replicate harm and oppression inside those bubbles, is disheartening and really disappointing. I'm so glad that you you're here with us and doing this work. So we are going to talk a lot about the Detention Facility Oversight Board that you serve as chair of, and how that's connected to this larger conversation about civilian oversight in the city of St. Louis. But can you tell us your journey of becoming chair of this board?
Sure. Yeah. I would say about sometime before May 2022, I was reading the St. Louis American, and I saw, I think, an article that featured a quote from Reverend Daryl Gray, who is now the vice chair of the board, about this board being created. And it was a really great time for my relationship with St. Louis City Government. Great things were happening. They were talking about adding nurseries to women's prisons so that they can spend a little bit more time with their children, for children who are born in prison. And then I saw a detention facilities oversight board was being created. And I thought that was terrific. I was engaged with the Close the Workhouse campaign. I was feeling like change is coming. St. Louis is improving. The government is doing better by its citizens. So I applied. There were a couple of different, the way the board is structured, there's 9 members. Each person was accepted under a certain role. So we have someone with corrections background, James Dom. He was used to be a corrections officer at the City Justice Center. I am the 16 to 24 year old member. There's a member related to civil rights, someone with formerly incarcerated experience, someone with healthcare experience, with legal experience, those kinds of things. So the board started. I was really passionate about it. And we just voted. I think someone nominated myself as chair and Reverend Gray as chair. And I just got more votes and now I'm chair.
Well, good. We're glad.
We're glad.
Yeah. I want to ask you about sort of the how you understand your mandate in that role. But I want to do it with a long preamble, just for folks who weren't following as closely as these things were being created. Part of the, and please, Janice, at any point, if there's something you want to insert, please insert it in my long preamble. Feel free to interrupt. But in 2021, there was, you know, a very public uprising in the CJC. This was before the workhouse was emptied out, but the uprising took place in the other jail in the City Justice Center. And it was local news, it was national news, and people inside, keep in mind, this is in the midst of COVID, sort of broke out windows, were holding signs, were saying things like they were being held in lockdown and they weren't being protected against the spread of COVID and other things inside of the jail and being mistreated. And that at the time, Mayor Lyda Crewson, in response to that, established this, I don't remember what the formal name of that was, but it was a precursor to the DFOB. It was kind of a jail advisory body. And that body met for a few months, the last few months of her tenure as mayor. And one of the things, if I recall, that it suggested was to create an oversight body. And so that's 2021, Tashara Jones comes into office. And there was legislation passed to create this DFOB. And then you spoke to the moment almost a year later in 2022, as the board was actually being populated and people were being brought into it. Also, by this time, the mayor had closed, no, excuse me, not closed, had emptied the workhouse once and then put some feedback people in it. And, you know, we won't talk about the workout story, but it emptied the workhouse, had committed to closure. And this DFOB was populated with the people that you just described. And how many members again on the DFOB?
9 members.
9. So coming into that, I guess what I'm curious about is at that point, there's a little bit of distance. And that's not to say there weren't ongoing, because actually there was a second sort of protest some months later. There were other issues. But I'm curious, coming into this role at a time that was somewhat proximate, but also a bit of time removed from those moments of uprising in the jail, how were you thinking about your mandate and purpose in being there and then in leading this board?
Yeah, so I think I was following the uprisings and I was incredibly proud to see the marginalized members of St. Louis raise their voices and beg for help and beg for their humanity and their dignity. Mm-hmm. So when I applied to this, I figured that the city was interested in improving the conditions at the jail, probably for the sake of liability, but that either way, I could participate in this and improve conditions for people in the jail. And then sometime between being nominated to the board and actually beginning the board work, I believe were the six deaths of people detained in CJC. Mm-hmm. So that was informing everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that timeline, which I think we're piecing together, these uprising that happens when Mayor Crewson is still in office, Mayor Jones takes office. There's a tour, right? There's this huge tour of both jails, the CJC and MSI, that Tashara, Mayor Jones, Congresswoman Bush, Circuit Attorney Gardner, I go, and they are meeting with folks inside. And what I remember was, you know, what I thought was really compelling to Public Safety Director Dan Isom came. You know, there was a huge press conference, and that's the sort of picture that we continue to see anytime there's a comment about the jails, is the picture of Tashara and Corey in front of MSI for that press conference. But what you are hearing are folks saying, hey, it's taking too long for me to go to court. We're not getting out of our cells, right? We're locked down 23 hours. When we toured the jails, all of the recreational opportunities inside of the CJC was shut down. There was questions around the food, right? And the health and sanitation around the food. And then there were these patterns of abuse that we were hearing about with COs regularly tasing, assaulting detainees. And then the only process by which to file a complaint was to call on a CO, which often triggered retaliation. And so, you know, you sort of see the mayor come out of this press conference and say, we have a lot of work to do. We're going to get on this work. And this sort of sees the birth of the Detention Facility Oversight Board. Can you speak to what, you know, is the explicit mandate of the Detention Facility Oversight Board?
Yes. And I'll just paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me. But we are asked ultimately to promote and encourage improved conditions at the City Justice Center, not only for people who are detained, but for staff who work there. Part of this is launching investigations into misconduct and other detention incidents. That includes interviewing people who are detained, staff as well, receiving complaints, not only the jail's complaints through their own internal system, but systems outside of that can remain confidential. And then ultimately making recommendations on how to improve the conditions to the mayor and to the commissioner, Jennifer Clemens Abdullah.
So now this board is sort of embedded in the structure, you know, reporting to the mayor, working with the commissioner of corrections. The one other piece that I want to unpack a little bit is this pretty new structure that has been created around oversight, the Division of Civilian, I think DCL, the Division of Civilian Oversight. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit how the DFOB relationship to the larger Division of Civilian Oversight and that commissioner?
Yes. So the commissioner of the Division of Civilian Oversight is Matt Brummond. He is also our custodian of records. Himself and his staff help put together our meetings, send out the Zoom publicly, announce our meetings and our agenda. And the relationship between the DFOB and the Division of Civilian Oversight is not explicitly clear to me. Several things are not explicitly clear to me. But basically, they are the staff and the investigators come from that staff as well that facilitate our work.
That wasn't the case initially, right? Am I right that the Civilian Oversight Commission came after the DFOB?
I'm not sure on that. I believe in our original, the original ordinance, it does talk about the division of civilian oversight.
Yeah.
Okay.
We've definitely seen over the last, you know, less than a decade, almost a decade, the evolution of civilian oversight, because there really was none, right? And then in 2015, 2016, the city passes its first sort of civilian oversight board around policing. And then there is a board that is under this division of civilian oversight. It heavily focuses on sort of the carceral structure, policing, and then your board focus on facilities. These two boards have at different times been the source of many conversations around what's their power, right? What are they able to do? We know that the police union actually sued against these boards being created, right? Because there's constant tension about a government sanctioned and funded oversight board, but then the body that it's supposed to be, you know, providing oversight for has an issue with this sort of dynamic. And so we've actually seen these things go to court in the last year. There's a carve out for the detention facility oversight board. So, you know, there's this 9-member panel is tasked with both navigating all the things that we know are absolutely wrong inside of the jail and the staff. And it's a volunteer commission, right? It's completely volunteer. Everyone's a volunteer, but then you have the city staff. Before we go to break, I know we have to go soon. Could you just give us a top line about how that work is going?
Sure. It's going poorly. Our work is being obstructed not only by the Division of Corrections, specifically Commissioner Clemens Abdullah, but also by the city councilor's office. And that, to me, was a surprise. I did expect some tension with the Division of Corrections, but I did not expect tension with the mayor's office since we were nominated by the mayor. But we really haven't been receiving much support, I don't feel, outside of Matt and his terrific staff. And the community, of course.
Well, what a setup going into break. We're going to dig in much more to, you know, we've sort of set the stage of how you got here and what DFOB is and has been tasked with and the structure of it. So on the other side of the music minute, let's really dig into what the experience has been like and what kinds of challenges you faced and where you are now. We are going to take our music minute. And so we will be back momentarily. You are listening to Under the Arch.
I know a broken heart is what I made the fence, and you can read your sign, but can't take a hit. Had to shoot the sign, but can't make it fit. 7 digits written down, I'll be someone to call on. Today may not exist, it's like we all live in tomorrow. We're leading by example, watch the population follow. Oh, don't ask me for the price or the repair cost when your heart broken. Living life, living life, living life. Out of sight, out of mind, out of time. I can see that perfection sits in your bloodline. I can see that perfection sits in your blood. Living life, living life, living life. Out of sight, out of mind, out of time. Love the way your eyes dilate. When you look at me, I relate. As though we speak on dialect. Can't reflect with no time to waste.
Welcome back to Under the Arch. We are still a podcast where we explore the issues facing our communities and the people's fighting to transform them. And you just finished listening to our music minute. The artist is King Q or King K, but the song is definitely Perfection. And you can check it out where you find all streaming on any of your streaming services. Again, that's Perfection by King Q K. We're debating what the pronunciation is, but regardless, the song is amazing. So thanks for listening. And we're back with our guest today, Janice, talking about chair of the Detention Facility Oversight Board, talking about oversight of our detention facilities here in the city of St. Louis. And before we went to our music minute, you know, you gave us a word. You told us it's going poorly. Yes. And so we want to know, you know, from your perspective as chair of the Detention Facility Oversight Board. What are the things that you and the other members are hoping to do?
To do overall or to do about things going poorly?
To do overall, and then we'll talk about what we could do about things going poorly.
Sure. So to do overall, and I repeat it every time I go for, I attempt a visit, we're trying to improve conditions for detained people and staff. We don't want it to come to another uprising, but we also understand that if conditions continue the way they are, that will happen.
Yeah. Can you say more about how conditions are as you know them?
Yes, I will do my best. But as you know, or maybe you don't know, listeners, we have been blocked at just about every turn to see conditions exactly as they are from the voices of staff and from the voices of people detained. What we have heard is certainly not good news. And it is our duty to make sure things are safe, sanitary, and that is not what we are seeing. When I was on my last somewhat successful visit, I spoke to a man detained there, and he said that he has not been able to shower, that he only gets a shower about once every 2 weeks. He talked about how he was recently maced. So when you're thinking about that, he's been maced and he's not even been able to wash that mace off, which as someone who's been maced multiple times in the city of St. Louis, it is absurd. And I just generally don't believe chemical warfare should be used on people, especially not by their own government. So that's what we've been hearing, that people aren't able to speak to their family. They're not able to meet with their lawyers or other visitors in a reasonable amount of time, that mental health generally is suffering and there's not enough case management. We've only heard bad things, really.
Yeah, I just will say, you know, in part in the interest of transparency and full disclosure here, you know, Arch City Defenders has been litigating cases, I think we're down to one case now, against the city for conditions in the CJC for a couple of years now, shortly following that uprising that we talked about. And we have heard many times exactly the kinds of conditions that you mm-hmm. just described. And sort of early in the work for us, one of the things that we did was set up a hotline, which we then brought back a couple of times, because as you know, one of the things that is so difficult, nearing impossible for people inside of the jails is to get information to the outside world about the reality of what's happening on the inside. And part of the reason that the kind of abuses exist and persist is precisely because those systems, those institutions are so opaque. And the response that you get, you know, we've heard it a million times when we have either had, you know, had some public forum or sent a letter or had a campaign event and relayed what we've heard from people, mostly in phone calls from the jail and visits to the jail, is, well, you know, you can't trust everything you hear coming out of there. And that's just not accurate. And you don't have the same level of information that we, the city, has, because you're not in there every day. And so the DFOB is supposed to be the antidote to that. I mean, it's supposed to be that this board exists to be able to get information so that, you know, those untrustworthy advocates and organizers and activists who say things have a check by some neutral third party. And so it's especially, you know, for those of us that care about the conditions in the jail, I think it's especially galling and must be incredibly frustrating for you to be facing the yeah. same kind of response from city officials as you're trying to do the job that you've been tasked with doing.
Absolutely. It is incredibly frustrating. We certainly went into this trying to build working relationships with the Commissioner of Corrections. We sat down and met with her. We discussed our intentions to improve things, that we're not coming into it with a specific perspective or lens, but that we were open to any information that we get from the commissioner, from staff, from people who are detained. But that relationship has very quickly deteriorated. And I will say my experience this morning at the jail is very emblematic of our relationship. I let them know a week ago that I would be stopping by this morning. I gave them notice, as it says in the ordinance that gives us our authority. And when I showed up, they acted like they didn't know I was coming. They told me to wait just a moment. That moment lasted 2 hours, and they wouldn't even tell me that the tour wasn't going to happen today.
Wow. So then maybe this is a good time to turn to what you had sort of previewed earlier. Kayla asked, you know, what are you doing? And you said, what are we trying to do? Or what are we doing in response to the obstacles? So let's turn to the latter part of that. So you've been having all of these challenges with carrying out your mandate. How have you and other board members responded to that? How are you trying to respond to that?
Part of responding to that is trying to engage the public, trying to raise awareness for how things have been going. As you have pointed out before, there has been a relatively positive public image of the city's efforts on the part of the mayor's office and on the part of the Division of Corrections, their efforts to improve things. And part of improving our relationship and being able to fulfill our responsibilities is making the public aware that that is not necessarily reflected in their behavior. Another thing that I've been doing is routinely going to the jail and attempting a visit every Friday for the past 4 or so Fridays so that I can document when they deny me and I can document what happens the few times that they have actually let me have a jail visit. In total, counting today, I've been denied 5 times and I've been given 2 tours. The first one was not very thorough. We only ran into a few people who were detained there and working on the kitchen staff, and I think that was quite frankly an accident. And the second time, the tour lasted less than 15 minutes. The first conversation I attempted to have with a person who was detained there ended very abruptly and forcibly with jail staff physically pushing me out and telling me that the tour was a wrap.
So I'm sorry, because processing this in real time, you're saying that a board that is authorized by the city to have jail visits is being denied access to the jail, and then when you are granted access, it's limited in time, scope, and it culminates in actual like physical removal from the jail. And what is the commissioner, the jail commissioner, saying about this when that's reported to her?
Sure. So in short, nothing. I have not been able to get the commissioner to meet with me about any of these issues. The same thing happens with her in terms of her saying, I'll be back in a moment. And the moment is multiple hours. She actually kept me out of a meeting that she had with Director Brummond, even though I was there at the same time as Director Brummond. I was waiting patiently in her office. She didn't want me to come into the meeting. So she doesn't say anything. I can't get her to respond to my emails, despite the fact that the ordinance says that I am supposed to get written notice after every denial of why I was temporarily denied and when the next time I can have a visit happens. And every time I'm there, I remind them that that is their responsibility. Over email, I remind them that that is their responsibility. And I think the last 3 emails I've sent, I've gotten no response. I'm essentially just documenting things and talking to myself.
And then the other question I want to ask is, you also mentioned the city attorney. That's
city counselor's
actual title,
yes.
But I can't remember.
City counselor.
Thank you. The city counselor. And so what role is she playing in this obstruction?
Yes, I will say, she has had specific involvement in this obstruction. but I can't talk about that because that's confidential. But I can talk about her office's participation in this obstruction. One is, and the Commissioner of Corrections does this as well, the general misuse of legal ideas, attorney-client privilege, I believe is misused for the sake of secrecy. Additionally, the word confidential is thrown around for the sake of secrecy, even if something that's not confidential in any way is discussed. So the city councilor's office has, I mean, I'm not even sure what I'm allowed to say here. It's unclear what our...
Well,
what
we don't want you...
Sure. It's unclear what the board's relationship is to the city councilor. It's unclear if we are her clients, if she's representing us or representing the city against us somehow. It's unclear if she is our attorney and we are the clients, we should be able to waive attorney-client privilege and talk about these things, these obstructions. But that is not that has not been allowed so far, or if they allow it, they discourage it. Additionally, we talked about getting independent counsel because we have grown concerned that the city councilor's office is uniquely positioned to represent the city, but not particularly positioned to represent the board and the board's intentions of oversight. Of course, our oversight over a facility that has been infamous is a liability to the city. And you can see how there can be a conflict of interest there. However, we have found that even though the term refers to independent counsel, it is at the sole discretion of the city councilor whether we get special counsel, independent counsel, and the counsel would be chosen by the city councilor. So it's not quite independent.
So let me ask about something that I know is public because I've seen it. And again, we're recording this on Friday, April 28th. And my understanding is either today or yesterday, the board sent a letter to the mayor. Can you tell us about that letter? You know, what's in it? What are you hoping to come from it?
Yes. So I emailed that out this morning to a bunch of different media outlets. We met as a board Thursday to discuss this and approve it. It was originally drafted by board member Mike Milton. And it really goes over the obstructions. It goes over the concerning reports we have received about the conditions at the CJC. It also goes over the specific authorities and responsibilities we've been given and how those have been blocked at every turn. And the letter culminates in us making a few different demands, basically that the mayor can compel the Division of Corrections to provide us with the information that we need. A recent obstruction has been the commissioner and the director of public safety saying that we require more orientation. And we just want to ensure through the public statement that this is a genuine effort to allow us our oversight. And then that when we jump through these hoops and we finish the orientation, we will have all of the authorities that are stated in the ordinance.
This is shocking. I mean, it's shocking, and I'm sure it's shocking to our listeners, because it is actually this type of response to this board is really opposition, or is at odds with what Mayor Jones has said is her agenda and the goals of the work around reform, right? And so it really does create and fuel disillusionment with the idea that things are going to change. And it has to be a really hard place to be having to fight those who are supposed to be on your team in service to the vision of the DFOB to get to the actual people who need to be heard and the issues that need to be worked on. And so I know that that is just, that's difficult and hard. And it takes a lot of, is a very principled and courageous act to stand very boldly and out loud about what you all have endured versus, you know, sort of just letting it be. Right. And so I just want to commend the board on that, because it could have been easy. Some people get on these boards and just by virtue of being on the board, they let it go. But yeah, I'm glad that you all are fighting this for sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
As we near the end of our conversation, I want to invite you to kind of make the positive case for why this is really important, and why we should invest in it. And I do so from the standpoint of someone who, when the first, the precursor I described, the advisory board under Lida Crewson was first established. And then I think even when the DFOB was first birthed out of that, I think it's probably fair to say I would place myself in the skeptical crowd. I think Kayla's probably there too, but I don't want to speak for her. In terms of bodies like this and the ways that that we've seen them be created and stood up and exist so that the powers that be can point to something and pretend to care, but not actually to do the job of oversight and fixing the fundamental problems. Now, a lot has happened from the moment of conception to where we are now. And I say that to invite you and give you the opportunity to kind of respond to that skeptical view and give us, again, the positive case for, you know, what you believe is possible and what can really be gained through this process and through the DFOB.
Well, I will say, if you expect me to change your mind, I cannot. I think that your skepticism is incredibly valid. I encourage it. I think it helps to hold the city accountable and to hold the board accountable. And I believe that changing things for the better in St. Louis in general and changing things for the better at the CJC involves a multifaceted approach. Change is not just going to come through board actions. It will come through the board, through uprisings, through protests, through advocacy, through litigation with the city. The city should be held accountable on multiple fronts, and the community is attacking this issue at all fronts. The one thing that I do think is unique about the board is our subpoena power. I don't believe that the Civilian Oversight Board for the police has subpoena power. And when I read through the ordinance, that was the thing that jumped out at me as, wow, this board really has power. And of course, my feelings have changed a bit. But I also think that we are up against so much opposition from the Division of Corrections and, unfortunately, you know, from divisions of the mayor's office, because we do have power to change things. I originally believed that the board and the mayor's office and the Division of Corrections would have a shared goal of at least taking small steps, not monumental radical change steps, but small steps that would reduce the city's liability and make genuine, important improvements for the quality of life of people who are detained at the CJC. However, I'm starting to think that that is not a shared goal. Specifically, I get the sense that the city and the Division of Corrections does not believe that if people truly saw what the conditions are inside the facility, they would support it existing. I think there's this sense that it's too far gone. And if that is the truth, I want to see it. I want the community to see it. there is no justifiable reason whatsoever to block oversight. If the CJC is benefiting the St. Louis community, if it is positively contributing to the community in any way, let us see it. We're here to see the good, the bad, everything. But so far, we've just been blinded.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for that. Our listeners are, they're active listeners. And so for those who are listening and wondering how they can get involved or stay engaged around this conversation, what should they do?
A couple of things. If you have the stomach for it, keep an eye out for news related to the jail. I would also say if you are available, please come to our public board meetings. They happen hybrid, in-person, and virtual. We typically meet at 5 p.m. on the, I believe, the fourth Monday of the month. And I would also say, do not be discouraged from getting out in the streets and getting public and doing things outside of the board and outside of the board's capacity to advocate for your family and your children and your neighbors who are inside the CJC.
Wonderful. Well, that's a call to action, listeners. Keep your ears to the ground and your eyes open in this space.
And amplify what you've heard. You know, I think one of the greatest tools of accountability is telling the truth out loud as often as possible. And so the workhouse is empty because we've organized, and this can be improved if we stay organized. I just always believe in organized. If I believe in nothing, I believe that when people are organized, anything is possible.
Yes.
And so this is just another front in which we need to stay organized.
Yeah. Janice, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so glad that you made your way to St. Louis. I'm glad your road led you here. I'm glad that you are at the helm of this board, and really grateful you spent some time unpacking all of it with us today. And we certainly will be watching, following closely, and please let us know if we can be helpful.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I enjoy the opportunity to talk about these issues.
Even though you don't remember we went to college together.
Hey. I blocked that whole experience.
Now I understand why.
Yes.
We're going to take a very quick break and be black. A very quick break. And then Blake and I will be back with more of the podcast you are listening to, Under the Arch. Welcome back.
We hope you learned something from that conversation. We did.
Sitting here stunned.
It's really disappointing. And it just is a reminder that you really cannot take your eye off the ball, you know?
The work continues, Yes. And what I will say to our listeners is, like, in a world where there is so much going on, it can all feel overwhelming, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think we take it one day at a time, mm-hmm. and we try to ground ourselves in our values. And this is human rights. This is human decency. This is care and compassion, and we should be concerned at all times about the people in our population, in our city, who are often left in the margins and ignored, and those who are detained in our jails, those who are unhoused, those who, you know, are, you know, just completely in the margins. It's easy to allow structures to invisibilize them, but we can't let that happen. And so,
yes.
It's a lot of work to be done, but it's good work. It's important work because that work makes us safer and better St. Louis for all of us.
Yes, and that has to be what it's about. It's not about political silly season. It's not about personality politics. None of that. You know, our good friend Mike Milton this week has been talking about a lot of things, including this happening in the city and the predictable Post-Dispatch editorial board wants to make hay about Tashara's friends are angry at her. You know, it's not, none of that is important. What is important is what's actually happening to human beings inside of these cages.
Absolutely.
And that's always going to be what's most important. So everything else is just noise.
Yeah. And we've always said this, right? That we believe in conditions over candidates, right? The work of electing people like Mayor Jones, that work has to include accountability, right? It has to include accountability. The work of leading any institution or any structure has to have accountability, because as leaders, we all will fall short. We all will make mistakes. And so that work just has to continue. And that work is important. Yes. And that work isn't an attack. It's actually us being very clear on the mandate of why we go to the polls and elect progressives to these seats, so that they can address these issues in real time.
Exactly. Yeah, so this is an opportunity to get it right. This is an opportunity to get it right. It's now been named as a problem. So from the mayor on down, you know, the mayor, the administration, Department of Corrections, the civilian oversight, the city councilor's office, they all are public officials, and we expect them to get it right.
Absolutely. Let's run the credits, shall we?
Run the credits. Thanks to our team, squad, as always, at Arch City Defenders. They do work hard, and they work doubly hard this week. You know, we keep marking the time because we're doing this earlier than we typically do for the release. So you all are going to get this in a couple weeks. So our team did double duty at Arch City. That's Z Gorley, Angelo Vidal, and Johnny Wu Gabbard, who's always on site collecting our audio for us. And in action,
we have Zoe Griffin, who does a lot of the guest organizing, getting folks here. So we're grateful for that team. We're grateful for all the people who make Under the Arch possible. I'm grateful for you, Blake.
I'm grateful for you, Kayla.
You know, these conversations are hard. And we be doing them on Fridays.
Yes.
End of the day. And it just makes you want a margarita after the fact.
Well, if you need things to look forward to. And speaking of things to look forward to.
Dun, 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 July 29th, 2023, Action is having its Powerball, a blackout affair at the Hawthorne. By the time you listen to this episode, tickets will be available on our website. Buy a ticket, bring a date, buy a table. We're going to have a really, really great time, and I'm excited about it. So please keep listening for updates and make sure you get your ticket, because this event is sure to sell out.
Sure to, like a Beyonce concert.
Period.
Plus tickets flying off the shelf.
Beyonce, Adele, Usher. It's giving renaissance.
Okay, great. Well, I'm excited about that. Yes. In the meantime,
we need to thank our King Q or King K.
Yeah, please let us know. I think we can say it right next time.
This is King K. And I don't know how we got there, but either way, the song Perfection, we thank you for allowing us to have this song as our music minute. Again, you can find that any place where you listen to your music, and you can find us on any place where you listen to your podcast, and we do want to hear from you.
Please let us know. Shoot us an email. Shoot us a message. You know, an emoji. Send whatever you want. Just say hey.
Just send something.
Yes. And until then, we just thank you for listening. The weather's beautiful. It's spring. Get outside. Smell the roses, as they say. And we will be back with you soon for another installment of Under the Arch.
Talk to you later.
We have come so far to go.